We got quite a way through 16. That's a long chapter. 16. And I have it around verse 44 or so.
That's where my mark is.
And so is there anyone that wants to like read 44 through 59 to get us rolling?
I'll try it.
Okay.
Look, everyone who uses proverbs will say the proverb about you, like mother, like daughter. Are you the daughter of your mother who despised her husband and children? You are the sister of your sisters who despised their husband and children. Your mother was a Hittite and your father an Amorite. Your older sister was a Samaritan who lived with her daughters to the north of you, and your younger sister was Sodom, who lived with her daughters in the south of you. Did you walk in their ways and do their detestable practices? It was only a short time before you behaved more corruptly than they did. As I live, the declaration of the Lord God, your sister Sodom and her daughter have not behaved as you and your daughters have. Now this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, plenty of food, and comfortable security, but didn't support the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me, so I removed them when I saw this. But Samaria did not commit even half your sins. You have multiplied your detestable practices beyond theirs and made your sisters appear righteous by all the detestable things you have committed. You must also bear your disgrace, since you have been an advocate for your sisters, for they appear more righteous than you because of your sins, which you committed more abhorrently than they did. So you also be ashamed and bear your disgrace, since you have made your sisters appear righteous. I will restore the fortunes of Sodom and her daughters, and those of Samaria and her daughters. I will also restore fortunes among them. So you will bear your disgrace and be ashamed of all you did when you comfort them. As for your sister Sodom and her daughters in Samaria, and her daughters will return to their former state. You and your daughters will also return to your former state. Did you treat your sister Sodom as an object of scorn when you were proud, before your wickedness was exposed? It was like the time you were scorned by the daughters of Aram, and all those around her, and by the daughters of the Philistines, those who treated you with contempt from every side. You yourself must bear the consequences of your indecency and detestable practices. This is the Lord's declaration. For this is what the Lord says: I will deal with you according to what you have done, since you have despised the oath, my breaking the covenant.
Okay. Great. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Seth. Yeah. Yeah, we were
all right, Carol.
Yeah.
You're the official.
Yeah.
You and Don. What you guys can do.
Yeah.
So we're still in this fairly long condemnation that God's giving of Israel, the southern kingdom of Israel. And he's getting now into this situation where he's comparing Israel to these other nations. So what are the main points he's trying to make?
They were bad, but you are worse.
Yeah, they were bad.
You're outdoing them.
Yeah, so one of the things he's saying is they were bad and you're worse. And he's even saying things like, you're justifying them. It's kind of like when people say, when you point out sin and they say, well, everybody does it, right?
Mm-hmm. Rationally.
Yeah, so there's a sense in which Jerusalem is giving a defense to Sodom and other nations that have been judged by God, because God hasn't judged her yet and she's doing worse than them, right? Mm-hmm. So you can kind of say, well, look, you know, Dad, if you're going to ground me, what about Brother mm-hmm. Joe over here, who's, mm-hmm. right? So there's this whole issue too, where as she surpasses them in her sin, and also because she had more light, then she's essentially making it look like God was too harsh to judge the other ones, since he hasn't judged them yet.
This spot here, I may be getting too far down the line, but where it says, when your sister Sodom and her daughters return to their former state, mm-hmm. what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
I thought Sodom was
the first thing I
mm-hmm. annihilated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why I mentioned that.
Right.
55.
So notice in verse 55, when your sister Sodom and her daughters return to their former state, and Samaria and her daughters, so the northern kingdom, then you and your daughters will return to your former state. And then he talks about bringing back captivity,
yeah.
right? So if you put that together, this idea that he's going to restore, if you forget the Sodom part for now and you just think about, he's saying he's going to restore the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and he's going to bring back their captivity.
Did this kind of go with that verse about taking captivity captive today?
It has a similar idea to it, the idea that a former state of captivity is going to be overthrown. Restoration is going to follow, right? So there's that idea. And he's talking about, that you will bear your own shame and be disgraced by all that you did, verse 54. So when you put those things together, you get this picture that he's talking about a time of restoration of the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, also Sodom, and he's saying that at that time you will bear your own shame and be disgraced. So there's an implied understanding that at that point they will be righteous enough to see what they did before as being sinful and be repentant for it. So I think when you put all that together, I think it points to the millennial kingdom,
okay.
mm-hmm. where much of what's been overthrown before will be restored, and even places and nations that have a reputation, like Egypt and other places that had a reputation biblically prior to that time of a bad reputation, will be blessed and be obedient, following the Lord in that time. So that's how I see it. I see it as a reference again, you know, looking far down the road, saying that even though you're worse than Sodom and I'm going to judge you, I am going to restore Sodom and Samaria and your estate as well. And he's just kind of trying to make a part of what he's making. He's saying several things. I think he's comparing them to Sodom, and he's saying, and you know, you even made reference to how bad Sodom was in your pride, and yet you're like Sodom now. Mm-hmm. But he's mixing all these things together, and in the midst of it, he's, I think, pointing to this time of restoration, because as we get into the next passage, we'll see that also the theme of restoration.
Besides being a city, I mean, it's a city-state, right?
Mm-hmm.
But was it also an area? Is that what
they were,
kind of tells you?
Yeah.
Because if you're going to bring back captives,
mm-hmm.
there has to be somebody there to do it. That's
right.
What I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when he talks about Sodom and her daughters and so on, you'll see Sodom referred to as Sodom and the cities of the plain. So there's this idea that Sodom is a city, but it's also with other cities, kind of a region,
okay,
that God
region.
That God wiped out. But there's a time when He will restore. He will restore mm-hmm. that the fortunes of that of, you know. And so part of the thing that is difficult biblically to trace sometimes is when God uses when He uses words for regions. And we'll get to this when we get to Ezekiel 38 and 39. He uses words for regions that are have currency mm-hmm. at that time, and sometimes it refers to a geographical region in that same area. It might be called something different in the future, mm-hmm. but He's referring to the area. Other times it's referring to the descendants of the people that He has in mind. You know, He wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah, but of course, you know, you could say, well, Lot was a person that came out of Sodom, and his descendants weren't all wiped out. So
everybody that was from Sodom and Gomorrah weren't necessarily living there when the area was wiped out.
Right, and so okay. in the case of Lot, obviously, he escaped and his daughters, but. And then the descendants that came forth from that, which of course would have been the Moabites and Ammonites. But then you also have the potential that He's talking about the region too, as opposed to the people. So I'm not sure, you know, which one would take precedence here. But part of what He's trying to say is Sodom has coinage, or, you know, it has a meaning more than just Sodom, right? It has a meaning like sodomy, for example, right? Mm-hmm. We have this term sodomy. And that comes from Sodom, obviously, and as Jerry pointed out, I think a couple times back, Jerusalem is referred to as Sodom in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation. So there's this whole issue where Sodom has become a byword for you know, depravity and sin of a particular type. And so I think by him mentioning, not only are you worse than Sodom and that you were prideful in saying how bad Sodom was, but you yourself are like Sodom or worse, but the fact that he's going to restore, you know, he's also saying that something as bad as Sodom, I'm eventually going to restore things to overcome that. But there is, you know, you can look at that and say there's nothing so bad that God can't restore it if he wants to as well. So when he mentions Samaria, that's the northern kingdom, the capital of the northern kingdom. So as I was mentioning before, when you're reading in the Old Testament, you'll see different terms used for the northern kingdom. And you kind of have to look at the context to see how he's using the term. Sometimes he'll use Israel and he means everybody that's a descendant of the man Jacob, who is also Israel. And other times, if it says Israel and Judah, then he's talking about the northern kingdom of Israel and Judah is the southern kingdom, and sometimes he'll say Judah and Samaria, right, where Samaria is the northern kingdom, so he's the capital.
I heard that there's some places in there where it's called Jacob also,
mm-hmm.
and one is, it was explained that, that at that time they're acting more carnal, more physical. When they're acting spiritual as a nation, then he refers to them as Israel.
Are you thinking Jacob or Jeshurun? Is a different term. Jeshurun.
I think it was Jacob, but I'm not sure.
Yeah,
it could be.
Yeah, I'm not sure about. I'm not sure that I've seen a pattern like that. But I'm not saying it couldn't be. I haven't really looked at that aspect of it.
So tell me that if you're talking about Samaria being another name for the northern kingdom, then Sodom wouldn't be the other name for Judah then.
Not here it's not. But in the book of Revelation, it talks about our Lord was crucified, and it references the city of Sodom, Jerusalem.
Egypt and Sodom.
I think
I've never really heard that.
Okay, well, let's look
Samaria
at
Samaria being another name for the northern kingdom.
Oh, well.
But then I'm thinking about the southern kingdom then, because the way he says it here, north and south. in verse, what was it?
46.
Six. You know what I'm saying, Tony?
Let me go back.
Your older sister of Samaria, who lives north of you, but her daughters and your younger sister.
It lives south of you, is Sodom.
It's Sodom. So right. Then, if you're saying Samaria is Israel, northern kingdom, then I'm thinking, okay, Sodom is Judah, southern kingdom. Am I wrong?
No. Yeah, you're wrong.
Okay, so
he's talking about three things here. He's talking about Sodom to your south, Samaria to your north, and Judah is in between. Who he's talking to, Judah is in between. So he's saying Sodom and Gomorrah, which is down toward the Dead Sea.
I was thinking
northern part of the Dead Sea, roughly.
Right, because then you were mostly talking about Jerusalem, right?
And yes.
But this is really Judah.
Well, he's talking about Jerusalem. And Judah and Jerusalem overlap a lot because
the city is in Judah. Okay.
And the king is from Judah and he's in Jerusalem.
Okay.
So,
and it's actually, he is referring to cities in this.
Right. This is talking about cities because Samaria is the capital city of, was this, and at the time he's saying this, Samaria
is. The capital city of Israel.
Of the northern kingdom.
Of Israel, but Sodom was.
A separate. It's not Israel at all.
Okay.
It's not. Yeah, so.
Oh, okay.
Samaria and Sodom both have been overthrown at this point, if you want to look at it that way. I mean, Samaria had. Samaria was taken into captivity by the Assyrians and then repopulated with people, you know, which some of the Samaritans came from that. But. So it still exists, but it's not considered the northern kingdom of Israel anymore at the point that he's stating this.
Okay.
Because it fell in 722 and we're in the
690. Okay, so that gives me more context.
Yeah, I mean 590.
In my brain refresh.
Right.
Okay.
So what I was referring to in Revelation.
No, you're talking about the Samaria.
Yeah,
Israel connection.
Yeah, just.
I mean,
well, it just says in Revelation 11, 8, there's these two witnesses that are killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it says in verse 7, when they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom in Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. So notice, Egypt has currency and Sodom has currency. They are, you know, they have, in a sense, they're figures of speech for godless, apostate areas.
Yeah, it almost sounds a little, it's like the Gentiles have taken over, in a sense.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what it's saying. I think it's just saying godlessness because it goes on. It goes on to make clear that there are Jews primarily.
I have a note here. It says with Sodom sexual immorality and then with Egypt
idolatry.
Bondage.
Yeah, and bondage, right?
Yeah, bondage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because mystically it's called. Figuratively.
Right.
Symbolically.
Yeah. So this is also, since we're here, there's this idea too that people do whatever the heck they want to do with the book of Revelation. They just won't follow the rules of language. It drives you nuts. Because people want to make Babylon Rome. They want to make Babylon be Jerusalem. And then they want to make, here it says Sodom is Jerusalem, right? And so what's so weird about this whole thing is they use some of these things where it's clearly saying this isn't literal, like spiritually here. Because it says that, you know, it's using the term Sodom and Egypt to refer to Jerusalem, and it's giving you the clear clue it's not literal, because Egypt and Sodom aren't the same anyway, right? And so elsewhere, when it refers to things, people want to kind of pour Jerusalem into everything and anything they want, just because it says here spiritually it uses a different phrase. It's like the verse that says a day is with the Lord like a thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
So then they want to make a day mean a thousand years everywhere, right?
Right.
And the whole point is in that verse, a day is like a thousand years to the Lord. The term day means a day there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean 1,000 years.
And
it means a 24-hour day is like 1,000 years to God. It doesn't matter. Doesn't give you license to say that the word day means 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a complete misinterpretation of the verse. And so the same sort of thing happens here, where because it says, well, it refers to Jerusalem as Sodom and Egypt, then they want to go over and say, well, Babylon is Jerusalem too. But then that makes just a mess with everything, because when you go through Scripture, what you see is God is constantly talking about, you know, if you want to talk about a tale of two cities, which is normally London and Paris, but the tale of two cities in the Bible is Babylon and Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if you want to mix those up and mess around and overlap them, you're going to have huge confusion.
Well, they're swapping.
Yeah.
We do that too.
You're just going to end up with total confusion.
Yeah.
So
Babylon's the one that gets kicked all over the place.
Yeah.
Even New York City and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah. So one of the frustrations, and that's a whole different rabbit, but one of the frustrations about biblical prophecy is that it's just so abused that you know, it's so frustrating. Anyway, so you can see here that Sodom has this reputation, which it refers to in the passage, right, in Ezekiel 16:49. And again, look what it says there in Ezekiel 16:49.
Right. Yeah. Gonna go back.
Yeah.
Okay.
This was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. They had pride, they had fullness of food, abundance of idleness, and they didn't strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty. Oh, and last, they committed abomination before me.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Yeah.
More of a list than you usually hear about it. You know, you always just attach one thing to it, not all the others.
Right. However, this verse is
what leads to it.
This verse, it's what leads to it. Now, that's an excellent observation.
Because you think of David being an idol.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, think about the USA.
Yeah.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we on that list?
Mm-hmm. We're not worse.
But the other thing is that this list is used by people who want to soft punch homosexuality as Christians. They want to soft sell and pull back on condemnation. I've heard teachers, I've been in churches where teachers have gone to this verse to try and teach that, you know, what went on in Sodom with people, homosexuality wasn't really that big of a deal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they must get the verses where they get destroyed?
Yeah. Or
well, they were. They would say, yeah, they got destroyed, but here's why. Fullness of food, pride, and abundance of idleness, and they didn't uphold the poor and needy. That's the main thing. And they get to the bottom of the verse, and they come in.
What did the angels see when they walked in there, and they tried to rape them? And you know.
I know. I mean, it's just crazy. But,
amazing.
But you'll be just, it's just surprising how people will go to certain verses and try to leverage it. And so people go to this verse and try to leverage it to teach that, well, Sodom wasn't really that bad. You guys who are all focused in on this sexual thing, it's really not that big a deal.
Isn't it interesting how it's often the error of omission instead of, you know.
Right.
So it's not like we're not teaching this when we go through verse by verse that we'll just, you know,
right. Right. Spin it a certain way. So, but it does give you insight to some of the, you know, when God is looking at Sodom, you know, he's looking a lot broader than just the fact that they went after strange flesh, as it talks about in Jude, right?
Okay, so where it says Sodom and her sister, is that Gomorrah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's talking about the city, related cities, the phrase and sisters. Because in general, when it talks about sisters, it's talking about cities. So, you know, we talk about Sodom and the cities of the plain, you know, in other passages. And also in Jude, where it talks about the angels that left their first estate, it compares it to Sodom and the cities. So I'm thinking that those are the sisters and daughters and sisters. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So And you see here he gets into this, you're your mother's daughter, and he talks about Hittites and Amorites, and we touched on that before, this idea that when he talks, earlier he talked about Jerusalem, you know, coming forth from Canaan, essentially. When he talks about the history of Jerusalem and talks about her origin, he made reference to two different origins, essentially, and mixed them kind of together. He's talking about the city, he was talking about that the city was originally run by Jebusites, or you know, they were owned by the Jebusites, and David took it from the Jebusites, and the Jebusites are listed in between Hittites and Amorites in the Ites that are in the land of Canaan. And so the idea was the city, regardless of who lived in it and came through it, the city has this history going back from Canaan. And the influences that were in Canaan came through and blossomed in the city even when the Israelites were there. And then there's this other background that where he talks about Israel coming out of Egypt and coming into the wilderness and so on. And so that even though he took Israel out of Egypt, as people say, he took Israel out of Egypt, but he couldn't get Egypt out of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, mm-hmm. He brought her into Canaan, and the whole idea of bringing into Canaan was to separate and keep Israel separate. And the reason, you know, one of the primary reasons they were to kill the keep people in the land of Canaan, one was because it was God's way of judging those people at that time, but also so that his work that he was doing with Israel wouldn't be polluted and come to naught. So that separation was a big part of it. And so here in talking about Jerusalem, he keeps reminding them also of this influence that has to do with the fact that they've amalgamated the pagan practices that were there into what was supposed to be a separate thing. And so there's lessons for us in relation to Christianity, obviously, and other religions, that, and then also just on a personal level, you know, how we, you know, it's easy to mix, to bring along things that God doesn't really want anything to do with, or that celebrate things that he doesn't condone, and then just kind of mix them in with the new Christian.
When and we're full of this stuff of taking pagan holidays and making them our own holidays.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that applies to that too?
Well, yeah. So I think when you can clearly show there's a direct connection and what we're doing is turning a blind eye to that meaning today in our own day, then I think, yeah, I think it's something we should avoid. You know, to me, Halloween falls in that category.
If we know the difference. Like the Easter eggs and Easter bunny.
Yeah. And then there's the other side of it, which is, okay, like if you read, you know, and I've got a bunch of different articles about aspects of Easter, and there is a lot of bad teaching out there about the origin of some of these things. And so you can get in a situation where virtually everything is off limits, and you know, you just. But I don't like Christmas trees, you know, on and on it goes. And then when you actually go back and look, you know, more closely at Saint Nicholas and aspects of Easter and stuff, there's considerable disagreement among people who've studied it about just how pagan some of the connections are. They admit certain things are, and other things it's not so clear that they're as pagan as people think they are. But that gets back, I mean, clearly when you look at something like Easter eggs and rabbits, it's obviously talking about newness of life and fertility,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, those are not the, you know, the Bible doesn't sit around and emphasize rabbits and Easter eggs. And in general, when fertility does come up, in the Old Testament, it's worship of pagan fertility symbols. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Easter, those aspects of Easter, I think, are things that we need to be pretty wary of and not be involved with. Similarly with with Halloween. I mean, it's a celebration of death and evil that people try to paint in a friendly way, to where if you're serious about Christianity, why would you even fool with that? Because if you just do a study of witchcraft and divination through the Bible, I mean, God is just, he just hates it.
So they take Halloween and make a harvest party out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
they should do it on a different day.
But yeah. But then they do it to say, well, this is so the kids won't be out there doing their things, you know.
Right.
So it, you can bend all this stuff around to put a righteous aspect on it. I mean, to try to in all of these things.
That's where the question I always go is, okay, so if there wasn't Halloween out there, would you be doing a harvest party?
Yeah.
And most people wouldn't be.
Right.
And that's the part where I go, okay, so we're doing a substitute, but ultimately, you know, it seems to me like, what is your motivation at the core,
right.
You know? Is
right.
it really to celebrate harvest? Or is it just a substitute
yeah.
and a tone down, and we still dress up, just not in evil
and,
costumes?
And the kids still think it's still Halloween.
And they still
yeah.
think it's Halloween, and they still
right.
go, well, I'm still part with my friends,
mm-hmm.
I'm still accepted by my friends, da-da-da, and I went here versus there. And, you know, there's that alternative, but at the same hand, at the core of it,
mm-hmm.
what are we teaching and doing? We're saying, well, in the church we can have a clean Halloween, you know, we just won't celebrate, you know, the witchcraft, but yet why are we dressing up and da 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 da,
yeah.
you know. But, so I kind of go back to the, if it wasn't a substitute, then are you really doing it as a harvest party? You aren't.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
doing it as a Halloween substitute,
yeah.
and that's kind of where I...
I think it depends on person.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends on each person and how
mm-hmm.
they feel about it,
mm-hmm.
and how much it bothers them
mm-hmm.
to be doing it in the
mm-hmm.
first place.
Right.
If you're raised with a Christmas tree,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
you're not worshiping the tree.
Right.
You're taught that Jesus, you know, died on, I mean, died, was born on that day, but probably the day of conception.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
so it gets all tangled up,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
And I think God has to separate it
right.
out. You know?
So on the one on the one side, you've got naive syncretism of things God doesn't like
yes.
into Christianity. On the other extreme, you've got this legalism where you're just like trying to find a demon behind every tree and
mm-hmm.
ruining all the fun anyone
yeah.
would have about any family
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
you know, in my mind, I think this is one of those areas where grace, you need a lot of grace, because there's some Christians who are, you know, for them, it's just completely out, and they don't want anything to do with it, and others don't think it's that big of a deal to do it in a way where it's not an evil thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my stance
mm-hmm.
is I really wouldn't want to be involved with it, wouldn't want to sponsor a party like that. But as a church, I would be reluctant, you know, as an elder to suggest that. But if other people are involved in that, I'm not going to, like, come unglued
mm-hmm.
and... You know,
mm-hmm.
I think there's other battles that are the bigger battle.
You could actually say that, you could actually, you know, the dressing up part,
mm-hmm.
a lot of pagan practices is dressed up as something else.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
you could carry that however far you
right.
want to carry it.
Well, and you know, to me, I mean, you can say the same. I think there's other practices people just as Christians adopt all the time that I think are just as questionable, like aliases that they take on the internet all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people on forums representing themselves as women when they're men, and on and on and on. The whole idea that
it's kind of like the mask deal. You're
yeah.
saying not what you see is what you get.
Right.
You know,
so I think
the costumes are kind of that way.
Well,
or
yeah.
Can
so
be.
There's
can be.
They can be. So a lot of these things, there's the form and there's
mm-hmm.
the substance,
mm-hmm.
and I think you want to look at both levels. You don't want to just look at the form and just automatically conclude, because I mean God is a God of creativity
mm-hmm.
and of humor and of fun, and he also hates evil practices. Mm-hmm. Right? So he's not against creativity and humor, he's against evil practices. And so sometimes it gets difficult because what the world wants to do, the world wants to take stuff that God hates and mix it in such a way that it gets you to compromise and rationalize that mm-hmm. it's no big deal when it is something that God dislikes, mm-hmm. you know.
I know, I dressed up as an angel with big bright wings and white.
So
I was like a Christmas angel on Halloween, and I tell you, I got black for that one. That's just like, wait a second.
I was just thinking, when God convicts you of something,
right.
then it becomes wrong for you to continue in whatever.
Exactly.
Deb and I have,
like, once you know,
Paul talks about that.
And we have, Deb and I have, in the past, when someone would come to the door on Halloween, we'd just say, well, we don't celebrate, we're Christians,
we
don't celebrate Halloween. And as awkward as that is, at least there's a little
and
bit of testimony.
What was really strange is I know one girl was from a church, you know, and she was a Christian dressing up, and she was, like, taken aback, and said, oh, good, there's a seed there, you know, that, you know, think about what you're really doing, because she was, like, dressed as a witch and everything, but I knew she was, like, from a church. And,
well, she was a good witch.
You know, but, you know what I mean? It's
a
like,
white witch.
It's like, you get sucked in, I think, especially as youth, you
white
get sucked into things that you're not thinking the theology or the, what's really behind it all.
Well,
you know, and after we were in England during Halloween and open witchcraft stuff, and... You know, it changes your whole outlook. It's, you know, stuff was going on that was really dark.
Well, there is around here.
Yeah, and there is here, too.
Right here, the tip of the island is pretty...
Right,
pretty
bad. Stuff, and So, you know, once your kind of eyes are open, like Kathy said, I think you're right. You know, then you have to go accordingly.
Because if you, like Kathy said, if you think something's wrong and you go ahead and do it,
mm-hmm.
even if it's not wrong, and you think it's wrong, and you do it, then you're committing a sin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going against what you believe God thinks, you know, or the way
you're
serving your conscience. And sometimes, like I said, you can get real legalistic and, you know, things, and get kind of worked out about it, too, in your own thinking.
Right.
So then you can think, oh, that's really wrong, when maybe you're taking it a little extreme, too, you know, but,
Well, David and I were talking.
I know I can't do Halloween anymore, and that's cool.
We were David and I were talking yesterday, and he made this rash statement. He said that
rash.
Of all the people on the planet, the most balanced, mentally healthy, stable, fruitful people should be Christians. And I think that goes into this because. We don't want to be naive and condone things that God doesn't like. And at the same time, Christians should not be unbalanced wackos.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because God is not an unbalanced wacko. And you know what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
We've all met people that have a huge amount of zeal, but there's not as much wisdom and wholeness involved in it. And so, you know, and that's a testimony to God, because when people look at us and they know that we're believers, you know, they're looking for a representation of God from us. And so, you know, on the one hand, we see lots of examples of incomplete purging of evil that then comes back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Didn't sweep the house.
We didn't sweep the house, right? And then on the other side of the offenses, there's a tendency to major on minors, you know, and get really caught up in whether someone has a harvest party, and then meantime,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's backbiting and a love of money and all sorts of other things going on in a church or in a person's life that actually are maybe more serious than whether you had a harvest party or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but in here, you definitely see this emphasis on, you know, you become like the other people around you. Jerusalem, you're becoming like the sisters that
mm-hmm.
that I had to judge. And you know, I think if God was writing this today, he would be writing this to the church. He'd be saying, the visible Christian church, the professing Christian church in America, you know, you're looking like the non-church. You know, your marriage situations, your sexual activity outside of marriage, your situations with how you're handling your taxes, where your focus is on money, your lack of giving and support for the needy, your pride, right? Power, pride. I mean, all the different things that, you know, there's an analogy where in the way he wanted Israel to be separate from the nations there in Canaan, he has this similar idea for his people. We're in the world but not of the world. And so to the degree he looks down and he can't tell the difference between what we're doing, how we're living, and how people who are not born again are living, you know, there's Houston, we have a problem. And so this is something to think about as we read these things.
And one of these verses talks about, you know, feeling ashamed, and until they felt ashamed, they didn't stop doing it. And I was thinking how, you know, so they were saying, once you're convicted about, you know, these practices or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it's sin in general.
Right.
You know, and a lot of it, it seems like, I don't know what that word really, you know, feel, it's obviously not the word think, but, you know, you renew your mind, so... Does God sometimes, I'm sure he does things in different ways, that sometimes he brings out that feeling of shame and then the renewed thinking, oh, this is wrong, instead of always, oh, I went to the Word, oh, this is wrong, and now I feel ashamed. You know what? The
mm-hmm.
egg and the chicken, you know, kind of thing. Is it
mm-hmm.
feeling and then thinking, or thinking and feeling? And he probably does both, I guess it. But
mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting in hearing he was using the word feel. You know, because a lot of people feel like what they're doing is right.
Mm-hmm.
If it feels good, do it, you know, kind of thing. And they and I guess that's the part where you think, okay, at some point, God might, you know, or the consequences of their sin bring that feeling of, ooh, that was not a good thing to do, or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always that, you know, emotion deal, or
right.
thinking mind versus, you know, emotion, and
right.
you know, so we kind of
right.
emphasize that here, and it didn't say, well, you changed your thinking about this. No, he said you felt differently about this.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting.
Well, and the connection between, you know, rational thinking and emotions or whatever is a powerful thing that God has designed into it. You know, because there's times where one comes before the other and vice versa, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was coming back from an eye doctor appointment today, and I listening to a song on the Christian radio, and this is just a beautiful song, you know. And I wasn't analyzing anything, right? I mean, I can be kind of an analytic person, but I wasn't really analyzing anything. I was just in worship. But out of that emotion, it took me on a path of thinking about aspects of God. And so, would my mind gone on that path without that worship emotion?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, right then,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that to me is one of the beauties of how God has designed the human being, is there's this, you know, we want to kind of cleanly separate these things and put them in different
mm-hmm.
deals, and the church will, you know, through history has kind of emphasized one over the other at different times, but they all function together, and emotion is a powerful thing that God uses. I mean, there are, how many people have you met that, well, even myself, I mean, when I came to faith, it wasn't because I was sitting there thinking about my sin or thinking about I need redemption, you know. It was in the middle of a worship service where I was just kind of overcome with God is real and I want God. And, it, you know, I would have to say it was, you know, after that or in conjunction with that, or along the way to that, that the whole sin issue played in there too. But it wasn't
the trigger.
That wasn't the trigger, mm-hmm. You know. So I just think, you know, God, he moves on all these planes.
Mm-hmm.
And often it seems too that he will get through to people in ways that we don't expect. Like we would think, you know, like people would think with me, it would be, you know, a head thing,
mm-hmm.
and not an emotional
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it was, you know, where I was saved was in a setting where there was a lot less rationality and a lot more emotion. But at the time, that's what God had for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people, you know, you talk to people about the times where they come to understand God. It just varies all over the map,
yeah.
You know. And that's the beautiful part about how this all kind of works together.
Yeah, God uses all those things. The mind, to think with, you know, the emotions, everything. And so it shouldn't be unusual that he uses all of them to,
right.
You know.
That
to,
balance.
You know.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I was thinking rationale. I was watching a video, and this girl, this guy says, "You want a pizza?" And she goes, "Yeah." "You want a large pizza?" "Yeah." "What do you want to cut in, 8 or 12? And her rationale was, 8, she could eat 8, but not 12 of the same size pizza. Her rationale, and she was just as adamant about it, and she was right by her thinking. So you put that in other segments, and you're going, that doesn't even make sense. But to them, they can't get out of that mode. And he was trying to explain it to her, and she could not get out of that mode.
Well, it actually
like
makes sense. I only ate 8 pieces, you know. Or I only ate 1 just because it was the whole thing.
Jerry doesn't cut his pizza.
That must have happened.
Yeah.
That's the share.
Yeah. Pizza is just a flat enchilada.
Yeah.
Just roll it up.
Flatbread pizza.
Flatbread, that's right. It's not pizza anymore either.
No,
flatbread.
It's flatbread.
Yeah.
That's
same bread, yeah. Can't think of calling anymore.
So, in this same passage, notice in verse 62.
We didn't go that far.
Oh, we didn't?
No,
we
stopped at 59.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not that far. They're not in the same passage. Any other comments for verse 59? He did mention, though, he did mention covenant 59. I'm okay.
So the oath is?
Okay, so there we go. So, I will deal with you in verse 59 as you have done, who despised the oath by breaking the covenant. Okay, so now there's two things there. There's an oath and a covenant. So there's a bunch of covenants in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
This covenant apparently involves an oath. That gives us a clue.
That narrows it down.
Three clues. It's a covenant, there's an oath, and it can be broken.
Mm-hmm.
And it was broken. So what does that point to? Those of you who have looked at these things. Which covenant do you think is being highlighted?
Mosaic covenant?
The Mosaic covenant.
If you will do these things, I will be your God, and you will be my people.
Right, and but there's an oath taken by the people as well.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at that.
Well.
And, because when you look at a lot of these, if you look at like Abraham, the covenant,
everything was dependent on God.
He doesn't make an oath there.
Uh-huh.
And even the covenant to David doesn't make an oath. Let's look at Exodus 24. And we'll see this. And if somebody could read verses 1 through 8 of Exodus 24.
Now he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him." So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments. And all the people answered in one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. And he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has said we will do, and be obedient.
Yeah, and then Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people. But this is the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words. So this is an interesting passage, right? Because there's this blood involved, and the people start off the whole thing saying, all that the Lord has said we will do. There's the oath.
Mm-hmm. Now is this the Ten Commandments?
Yeah. So the way I remember it is 2020 vision is the Ten Commandments, and that's in Exodus 20. That's how I do it. 2020 spiritual vision comes from the Ten Commandments, and that's in Exodus 20. I don't know. Everyone has it. I have another one for
that. That's pretty good.
Here's the one for the Ten Commandments. This is a weird one, too.
Okay, say it again. Mm-hmm.
This is for the Ten Commandments. This is a weird one, too. It's Jin, G-I-N, makes you smash. S-H-M-A-S-T.
Yeah, we're never going to remember
this
that. 2020, we can remember.
This is the British one.
So that's God, idols, name, Sabbath, honor, murder, adultery, stealing, testimony. And the last one
we need
is
a whiteboard.
Is, let's see, it's
coveting.
Coveting.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So
that's an interesting
again?
Rationale.
Yeah.
Gin
makes you snap, you see. So whatever, as long as you can remember. Right?
That's how I remember the Geld, the books of the five books, you know, Geld, G-E-L-M-D.
Oh.
Geld, same type of thing.
Books of what?
The
first five.
Genesis. Oh, I'm thinking Geld like
yeah.
J.
No,
that's not going to help me.
And I thought, there's another one like KP, coffee, good stuff. That's kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Or there's another one. Some people have curly black hair through persistent breastfeeding. And that's the sign is perpendicular over hypotenuse.
Yeah, I remember that one.
They have one for the color code and the
resistor.
Electrical color code.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give that.
No,
up.
I know. It's fairly crude. I've
yeah.
heard that too. But anyway, so there's all these little ways that.
I just know Lefty Lucy riding tight.
Yeah. And usually it's the goofy ones that stick. It's the problem, right? So.
Or some.
Usually you're embarrassed to share them.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But notice that. There's a covenant there. There's blood involved,
mm-hmm.
sprinkling with blood. And they explicitly come under that covenant by being this blood sprinkled on them, and they make an oath. They say, this sounds good. We're going to do it. And so that's there's a significant too, and it talks about that. In verse 7, he took the book of the covenant and read it in their hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's after he wrote all the words.
Right? Yeah.
Verse 4.
Right. And so there's this whole business of they came under that, essentially, at that point.
That's the marriage.
Yeah, and it's also a marriage because, like we saw last time, there are marriage overtones in it. It's a different passage. I'll just read it. We'll go there in a little bit because we're going to get to the New Covenant in a minute. But in Jeremiah 32, God makes the point in there that when he's going to make an everlasting covenant with them, that's not the right place. And Jeremiah 31 is where I'm supposed to be.
Oh, the new covenant?
Yeah. Well, we're going to get there anyway, because I'm just going to read another few verses so we can go there. But verse, okay, so back in Ezekiel 16, I'll just finish it out, verse 60 through the end of the chapter, which is, "Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. Then you will remember your ways and be ashamed when you receive your older and your younger sisters, for I will give them to you for daughters, but not because of my covenant with you. And I will establish my covenant with you. Then you shall know that I am the Lord, that you may remember and be ashamed and never open your mouth anymore because of your shame, when I provide you an atonement for all that you have done, says the Lord God." So, so notice in verse 60, he's saying, you know, verse 59, there was this covenant I made with you, and there was an oath involved, and it was broken. And then verse 60, he says, I will establish an everlasting covenant. Mm-hmm. So he's making some contrast there, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, there was one that you took an oath, and it was broken. This other one's an everlasting covenant. And he goes on to talk about that this covenant will provide atonement for all that you've done, including the things that you've done breaking the previous one. So when he says, you know, I will establish a covenant, you know, you can read in between the lines there, it's going to be new. In other words, a new covenant, a different covenant, another covenant. And, if we had Jews here, if we had some Jews who were practicing Judaism here who rejected Christianity, and one of the things they always say is, you know, you guys are changing what Moses said, right? So how could Jesus be a fulfillment of the Old Testament if he's establishing something different than what Moses told us, right? I mean, it's a new covenant. And the answer to that, as Christians, is, look, your book says it. You know, that book that you hold in such high esteem that talks all about Moses says that you're going to break that covenant, and because you broke the covenant, God has to do something else. And in that something else, it's going to be new. Mm-hmm. And you guys won't allow him to do this new thing. You're so stuck on the old thing, even though he told you, you're going to break it, I'm going to do something new. And you know what it's called? It's called the New Testament. But you won't allow it because, oh, it's different. There's some aspects that are different. It's new. Well, yeah. That's what your book says.
I would say maybe the word would be accept. You won't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much allow it, because they really don't have the permission to, you know, allow it. You know, I think they just won't accept it. And then the word, you know, everlasting, I think of eternal. But can it also be taken to be that, you know, because up here they could break it, and is this one more from God's point of view where they can't break that one? You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I think that's one of the contrasts here is,
so
one
can be broken, one can't be
one
broken.
Was broken, and the other is not going to be broken.
In other words, it's a better
covenant.
Which is what Hebrews...
One's a conditional covenant and one's an unconditional covenant.
Right.
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 That's
what I
was getting at. Good. I'm glad you said that.
And so you can't see it in this verse, but once you know more about the covenants, you can see that this covenant here is going to be based on the Abrahamic covenant, because that's unconditional. That's an unconditional covenant, and it's done in a way that really highlights the fact that it's unconditional.
Mm-hmm.
as far as
provides an atonement.
Right, and it provides for atonement. So it also gives you a hint that it's different than the Davidic covenant. It's different than the land covenant. It's different than some of these other elements that are emphasized as covenants, because it's land doesn't provide atonement.
Mm-hmm.
A throne with someone sitting on it, that just the kingly reign doesn't provide atonement. And you get the hint here when you look back at the oath part in verse 59. We went back and looked at there. What did you see was involved? This red yucky stuff called blood,
mm-hmm.
right? Actually, it's beautiful, but it's yucky too. If you're cleaning fish, it's yucky. So you also can see, you know, this is all, you know, 20/20 hindsight from the New Testament. But when you look at this, you can see how beautifully the New Testament just fits right in here like a hand in a glove when Jesus in the Last Supper says, this cup is my blood, the new covenant.
New covenant. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's verse 60 right here. You know, 59 there was blood, and 60 there's blood. But the blood's different. The blood back there was the blood of animals, and he shakes it on a little hyssop and puts it on him.
Mm-hmm.
This other one is the blood of the perfect lamb, which is another reason why it's an everlasting covenant. You know, and when we read things like this too, we should be getting very secure as Christians, because you know, when he's talking about everlasting covenant, he's talking about something that's atonement, and it's efficacious, as people would say. It's a really a strong thing he's talking about. But so in this he says, I'm going to establish my covenant with you, and it has this atonement aspect. And so that, and then Jerry mentioned when the oath was taken there was this marriage involved there, which isn't as obvious right away when you see that passage. But if we go to Jeremiah 31, which we're constantly at for a lot of good reasons, Jeremiah 31:31 or so, we'll see this where explicitly the phrase new covenant comes up in verse 31. God says through Jeremiah, and notice Jeremiah is a contemporary of Ezekiel,
mm-hmm.
and he's talking about some of the same ideas here. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, in other words, in the future, when I will write a new testament for the Bible. That's my interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah.
Okay.
And notice again, he's saying all of Israel at that point is divided, and a lot of the people from the north are dispersed and so on, but he's saying, I'm going to make a new covenant, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. That's the Ten Commandments. Plus, my covenant which they broke, though I was a suitor, a father, what to say, a husband to them. So there you can see again, we saw earlier in Ezekiel, he talks about wooing her and when the time of love had come, and he mentioned the covenant earlier there. So there's a sense in which it's certainly not highlighted heavily at the time, but when you go along through the Bible, you start seeing more and more God pointing back to that covenant and saying, you know, this is when we were married, and when you broke it, you became a harlot and adulteress, but you know what? I'm the ideal husband. You know, even though I'm biblically justified because of your immorality and your idolatry and adultery in rejecting you, that's not the heart of God. I'm going to take you back. So, there's a lesson in here too for divorce. You know, for people for divorce. Yeah, God says there are situations where it's legitimate, and if those situations arise and that's the and we initiate it and we're biblically justified, we're fine. I'm not trying to say you shouldn't do that, but you can see here that God is going a step beyond that. He's saying, you can be as unfaithful as you want. I'm still going to take you back.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for, you know, and this is where we are not like God. You know, he has bottomless love. He just, you know, he's just not, you broke it, yeah. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a new covenant, and I'm going to take you back. So in this, you can see how this helps us in that interpretation back there, because we see him talking about adultery, harlotry, marriage. Here it's talking about, though I was a husband to you. We back there we saw there's a covenant that was broken with an oath. We kind of traced it out and saw, well, that looks like the Mosaic covenant. Here he says it's the one you broke is the one when I led you out of Egypt, and that really identifies it for us. It's the Mosaic one, Mount Sinai. So
this is speaking. I know the tendency is, and it's probably true that the new covenant applies to us right now.
Mm-hmm.
But this is speaking directly to the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And is this fulfilled with the Jews when he comes back the second time?
Well, I think if you go on and read it,
I know certain Jews will become Christians.
Right. So there's a whole issue about the church's relation to the New Testament, and the New Covenant. And there's different opinions, but I'm one of those who has a pretty simple view of it. We're ministers of the New Covenant; it applies to us. And progressive revelation makes it clear in the New Testament
right.
that the church is in the New Covenant. Jesus said, we're doing the Lord's Supper on a periodic basis, and what's that based on? He's sitting in this room saying, this blood is the blood of the new covenant.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of try to say, like some people say, well, the church has a kind of a spin-off benefits from the new covenant, but isn't a part of the new covenant, to me, is just like, well, what do you mean? How can I be a minister of the new covenant, and Jesus, I'm doing this stuff, and Jesus talks about this, and then you tell me that I'm not part of this covenant? I find that really hard to support. So, but there are aspects of this that clearly haven't been fulfilled yet.
Right.
So when he talks about, I'll put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts and be their God, and they shall be my people. No more shall every man teach his neighbor. Well, what are we sitting here doing? We're mm-hmm. studying and talking and teaching. And so... And again,
so there's a timeline in this part.
Yeah, there's a timeline in this part, and in this particular passage. So there are Jews that are in the new covenant because they're, I believe, are part of the church, which is participating
right.
in the new
yeah.
covenant. But the part of, you know,
the nation.
Every man, you don't need to teach anymore. That isn't here yet. Not in any meaningful
right.
sense. And especially when you look at the New Testament and the emphasis of the New Testament, I mean, on shepherds, shepherds are supposed to feed. And what are they supposed to feed? It's God's Word. It's teaching, pastors, shepherds, teachers, whatever. So clearly, this isn't...
So it seems pretty clear to me that it's not going to be for the nations completely until... Because even in the millennial kingdom, because
right.
cause they mm-hmm. say, take us to your Lord, we hear you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so obviously they don't know, and they don't have this knowledge, and at that time, so maybe it's when they actually become saved. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's might be.
Well, there's a number of different interpretations of this. One is that it applies specifically to Israel. And that there will be a different relationship or knowledge among the Jews of God than there will be among Gentiles in general. But clearly the position of favor and focus in the millennium is on Israel. And
yeah.
even people who know God are going to recognize that, I mean, he's in Jerusalem, you know. And they're going to be going, as it says in Zechariah, they're going to be going to Jerusalem to celebrate feasts and things that have this Jewish background. So
So are you saying the thing about teaching each other is the eternal state?
No, I'm saying that I think that this will be true in the millennium
for the
Jews. Okay. It may not be true for everyone.
Right. Oh, okay, right. I got it now.
That was my point.
That's what it implies.
That's what I was
okay.
saying.
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't tracking that because I've always had this sort of thing. Well, when you see them face to face, and that's everybody. We're talking global here, but you're saying no, it's the Jews we're talking.
Well, that's the implication here. He's talking about the house of Israel and
yeah.
the house of Judah.
Yeah, but I've had wrong thinking in this here, in that particular verse till just now.
Well, it's difficult.
If that isn't talking just about Christians, though.
Yeah, see, I've always taken it as a global thing, but that's because
face.
I don't, you know, I have old teaching and I'm not always taking it into context until we get here and I go, oh, and this is one of those that I obviously had wrong. So, thanks.
Yeah. So when he says in verse 34, for they all shall know me from the least of them to the greatest of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you do with a verse like that? I mean, that's a hot potato verse. Because it, you know, at face value, it's teaching that there's a group of people that every one of them is going to know the Lord. And they're not going to need to be taught about the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it says.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, woe to me if I don't have the faith to believe it. But that's a tough verse. Why do I say that? Well, that's quite a situation. Right? Because especially if this applies to the millennium, which a lot of clues seem to indicate, you've got a whole group of people that rebel at the end of the millennium. So they can't be those people.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem with a verse like this is that...
Well, they have to be, obviously, believers.
Right. And well,
and
not just believers, but, you know, I mean, there's this whole... It says... it's.
Yeah, but I mean, and then we go to something even closer, which is the Jews. That's what you're saying. Right?
Well, yeah, I'm just saying that there's a distinction in this verse that's an uncomfortable distinction.
Right, because, okay, what's the least to the greatest? Are we talking the youngest to the oldest? What's that part?
I think there's a term for that. It's like creating the heavens and the earth. When he says
everything.
Heavens and earth, it's I think it's called a hendiasis or something, but it's a phrase that means everything.
Okay.
And this I think means everyone.
So I'm not taking
it. Yeah, it's from the baker to the candlestick maker,
okay.
From the priest to the king,
yeah, I didn't
from
know
the
that
pauper
language.
To the rich man.
Okay, then that makes it a little more
yeah.
So they all shall know me. That seems to me like it's like you said, it has to go into the eternal kingdom after the millennial kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
At this time. So all this stuff, it could be a progression along the line, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
That's God's
right.
The way He works.
Right.
Progressively,
right.
I guess. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So what a lot of people will do with this passage, you know, is they come in and they say, well, Israel and the house of Judah is kind of a spiritual term referring to the people of God. We're the people of God. And He's written His law in our hearts, and that's what this means. But you know, when he says it, he doesn't won't need to teach anymore. That's kind of a tough one,
yeah.
Right? So anyway.
Well, that's why I always took it as an eternal state. Or,
well, it could be, you
but,
know, but
God, you know, Jesus, right there in the millennium.
Right.
So then, you know, I mean, you just added a dimension.
Well, then I think there's other verses that are tangential to this, like in Romans 11, where it says, all Israel will be saved.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we're to the Babel thing.
Yeah.
In this case.
Yeah.
So,
but when it says all Israel will be saved,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
that's another one of those verses. There's certain verses in the Bible that, you know, they're like 10 miles high. You know, they just are sticking up off the page. And those are some of those verses. When it says all and every. And you know, when it's talking about something that is not at all the natural case today, then it's like, whoa, that takes faith to believe that. All
right.
All Israel, we say. What do you mean?
I guess that's clean is, you know, you're not making these Venn diagrams and you're not doing subsets of other groups, people, whatever, you know. And if you just take it to black and white, all or nothing, then,
right,
you know, you're not making the distinctions,
right,
which is what I've been doing in this case.
Right.
And so this helps to know,
right,
you know, there's other ways to break this down to,
mm-hmm,
zero in on. Yeah, because if you're thinking everybody, you're going, how'd that work, you know?
Mm-hmm. So,
a couple light bulbs are going on.
Yeah. And this is this whole area, too, where I don't think we make enough distinction necessarily as the church between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, you know, because we spend a lot of time, you know, it's like we bounce between extremes. On the one hand, like, we ignore the Old Testament and don't know what's in it, and on the other hand, we're trying to take the Old Testament and force it on society, right? Or majoring on it, like, where to the degree where people look at the church and look at Christianity and they see that our primary concern is moral behavior. Well, that is an important concern, but it's not our primary concern. Our primary concern is reconciliation with God. That's our primary concern, and so that's where I think we have to keep reminding ourselves. Paul told us, you know, we're ministers of the New Covenant. Ministers of the New Covenant. We're not ministers of the Old Covenant.
Right.
Right. And the Old Covenant has some really, really neat things, a big smoking mountain and Charlton Heston and,
mm-hmm,
you know, rods being turned into snakes and all kinds of stuff. But when it comes to our focus should be kind of like this Ezekiel passage that, you know, the people we're talking to and even our own, you know, the church at large is kind of like Jerusalem in that passage of Ezekiel, right? There's all this goofy stuff going on that we're not walking in the ways God has and so forth. And so our focus is on, hey, there's this new covenant that's going to provide atonement. And it's not based on all these things we will do, right? Because when people get the picture that the reason you come to church is to learn about all these things we will do, to be a good person,
yeah, mm-hmm,
to live a moral life. And that's kind of the difference between, you know, we've talked about this too, that there's a large group of people that are into kind of moral majority, national pride, conservatism, right? But that's not Christianity. Christianity is talking about you're a sinner, you're lost, Christ is your only way, and no matter how sinful you are, you can get off the hook. And that's offensive to the moral majority often, and those who are you know, many people are conservative. We're good people should be good like us, and that's more their focus. And to them, you know, Judaism is in that, would be in there too. And the cross is a scandal because it's saying, no, you're not good, right? And so there's this issue where, yes, we want to look to the Old Testament because, you know, that God took these 10 and put them on stone. I mean, and they show up again in the book of Revelation with thunder and lightning and hailstones, and it's like, the moral law that he has there is still significant as far as if you're not in Jesus Christ, that's what judges you. But our point should be, look, escape the law of condemning you, right? And Jesus nailed the law on the cross and took it out of the way. So our message is, you know, this: if we're going to take you back to the old commandment or to the Old Testament, it's to scare you. Because without Jesus, this is what you got to do. All these things we will do,
what you can't do.
But you can't do. And so, you know, to me that when we focus on the Old Testament, it's like we're focusing on, you know, a giant freighter in a storm. I saw a movie last night with a freighter in a storm. And we're focusing on, be like this giant freighter in a storm and you'll survive. But no, that's not our message. Our message is we're the lifeboat. We're the little podunky lifeboat that's going to rescue you off that freighter, because that freighter is going to, it's going to shipwreck. It looks big now, but you don't know how big the storm is.
Mm-hmm.
And this little lifeboat is the only place that you're going to get off.
It seems to me like the Old Testament and the Gospels and the Jewish epistle all amplify God. They all let you know, learn about God. Where if you listen to Paul's, you get a certain, you get a different perspective of God, I think, than the law portion,
mm-hmm.
which is that. And this back here is what God expects and what God's going to get eventually from everybody that's going to be saved. But I think you understand more the mind of God by going through the Old Testament
mm-hmm.
than you do going through the New Testament.
Without it, yeah.
Yeah.
You need both, for sure.
Yeah, you need both. Mm-hmm. But I think it's easy to get off in a tangent if you just study the New Testament
mm-hmm.
because you don't get the full mm-hmm. blast of who God is
right.
and what he expects. And,
you don't get the full picture part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and of all the people, the Jews are the ones that got that full blast of who God is, found out they could never do all the things that God requires of us. And so that, of course, leads to Jesus down the line.
Yeah,
and that's the whole goal of like their marriage to, you know, God the Father, you know, that whole thing, relationship.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, that's God's deal, is relationship with mankind. And if you don't have that, then the New Testament tells you how to be reconciled
yeah.
and have that relationship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately. So if you don't have the goal, then, you know, and the motive, then...
I don't know, do they... In the Old Testament, I don't ever remember reading them, the Jews call him God Father.
No,
do they?
Husband, wife,
Jesus. I don't think they ever do. I don't think that mm-hmm. because that relationship isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
The Abba Father thing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that causes Judaism to have hesitation is the casual aspect, the Abba Father friend. You know, like I was listening to a song today. Let's see, the one that talks about heavenly armies. By Chris Tomlin, is it?
Yeah, it's the one that Mary...
God of Angel Armies. And it talks about the God of... I can't remember how the phrase goes, but he is a friend of mine.
Yeah.
The God of Angel Armies is a friend of mine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Chris Tomlin.
You know, that's 100% biblical and tremendously offensive to a lot of people.
Yeah, the Jews would what? God of
right.
friend?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
they don't even say his name.
Yeah. So there's...
Yeah, like it's interesting that...
Yeah, almost time for the rooster to go.
Let the rooster sing.
So,
rooster fell asleep.
What's interesting to me is, you know, in this Ezekiel, this is one of the most this chapter that we just kind of finished in Ezekiel 16 is a tough slog. I mean, it's full of really harsh language. Which is sexually graphic as far as the analogies that God is, the way he's communicating it, and it's long. And you know, so it's kind of like Leviticus or Deuteronomy, right? But look at what's at the end, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of in what you would think this obscure chapter that we really have to read through this, is this whole business of, you know, the foundation of Jesus' ministry, the new covenant, is just
mm-hmm.
sitting right there as a jewel at the very end. And also this just the idea that no matter how messed up and filthy and idolatrous and, you know, Sodom-like things become, God has the remedy for it, this new covenant. And, you know, the word that, the key word in there that is that word atonement.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, yeah, I got a way to handle all this. So to me, it's just a real encouragement. And I think it's, the, you know, the pattern in this chapter is the pattern that you see in most of these books, too, where it's pretty heavy going for a lot of chapters. And then you get near the end and the sun rises and the clouds go away and the birds start chirping and...
You mean like summer?
Yeah, like summer.